You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
Really excited to have this conversation with Kamir Khidia, who is a writer, physician, and anthropologist at Harvard Medical School and University of Zimbabwe, a Rhodes Scholar and 2023 New America Fellow. Khidia had worked on global mental health research, practice, and advocacy for the last decade. He's got a new book. The book is called Empire of Madness, A Physician's Case for Reimagining Global Mental Health. Enjoy the pod. Cam, welcome to the podcast.
My goodness, it's such a pleasure to be here, Kelly.
So you open this book with a scene from Zimbabwe. It's on a wooden bench under a tree where a grandmother is talking to a young woman. What is happening in this scene?
So this is a scene from the Friendship Bench, which is this intervention that was developed by a psychiatrist from Zimbabwe, Dixon Chibanda, a friend of mine, brilliant, brilliant guy, who saw the emotional and psychological toll that, the political and economic environment was having on folks in Zimbabwe, where at one stage in the early 2000s, the prevalence of depression, anxiety, and those kinds of common mental disorders was greater than 30%. So much greater than we would expect. And so he designed these benches that go outside of clinics, usually somewhere shady, in public, so everyone can see that this is happening. It's not something hidden away. And on these benches, he trained grandmothers, many of them illiterate, to deliver basic cognitive behavioral therapy in 6 sessions. And he did that with them in concert. They came up with the principles and idioms that they would use to address those mental health problems that were local to Zimbabwe. For example, folks in Zimbabwe don't say, I'm depressed or I'm anxious. They say, kufungisisa, I am thinking too much. And so these are like natural idioms that people use to express their distress. And the grandmothers felt like these would be far more appropriate than some of the psychiatric terms that Dixon was asking them to use. And he listened to what they were saying. Anyway, they went on and tested this intervention in a very large randomized control trial that showed that it was more effective at alleviating the symptoms of common mental disorders than usual medical care, including antidepressants, which is a very, very kind of profound finding, especially for folks in the West to read. It ended up getting published in the Journal of American Medical Association, which is a major kind of landmark journal that we all use here in order to figure out what the good evidence is for what we should be doing in healthcare. And so it was a real coup for him to be able to show the world that what these grandmothers were doing on a wooden bench outside of a clinic was just as good, if not better, than what psychiatrists can deliver in their clinics themselves.
So I was just having this conversation maybe a half hour ago with my friend Jen, who's got the office across the hall. We were talking before we came on. I've got a big surgery coming up next week. So I'm going to be, this is my last podcast. I'm going to be taping for like 2 months. And, you know, it's open heart surgery. But I have a 98%, survival rate. This is all good. And I said, the thing people keep asking me is, how do you feel? Because I'm asymptomatic. And I said, 70% of the time I'm fine, and 30% of the time I've got existential dread. And then
What are you dreading?
Well, and the other aspect of that is, like, in normal times, I think it's maybe 80-20. So it's and I speak from a place of great privilege in terms of, you know, I got a terrific zip code. I'm a white straight male, you know, a good insurance, all those things. So when, that showed up yesterday, I got the email with how much the surgery is going to be, and it is completely covered by insurance, but that number is gigantic.
Mm-hmm.
And I say all this because it's sort of like, are we, and you say this in the book, like, we're treating these issues as if they're abnormal when, frankly, they feel pretty darn normal.
Mm. Yeah. You know, I think a lot of mental distress, I want to reframe away from the idea of pathology or abnormality. Because I think that can be a very alienating framing for the way that folks kind of think about their mental distress. Instead, if you think about all that is going on in the world right now and how awful it is, feeling 20% existential dread, that sounds very, very normal to me, you know, like that is
pretty
a
good
normal reaction to some toxic circumstances.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, just today, like every day we get up and read the newspaper. Let's talk about a beautiful term, and I think it's come up on the podcast before, and it's, if I'm pronouncing it correctly, Ubuntu?
Ubuntu, yeah.
Yeah, talk to us about that.
You know, this is the African philosophical concept that kind of undergirds a lot of ideas in many different African cultures, but the short translation is, I am because we are. You know, in the West, we kind of have this Cartesian idea of things. I think, therefore, I am. Mm-hmm. In African philosophy, we say, I am because we are. And what this is getting at, really, is the idea that our well-being and the way that we perceive ourselves cannot be separated from those around us, that we are all part of a collective, and understanding ourselves that way relationally to those around us is a fundamental principle by which we live our lives. And I think for me, what's hard is that, you know, I am someone who grew up in Zimbabwe, and moved here to the States for college and then got trained as an American doctor. And a lot of that process and that training was in some ways an unlearning of some of these principles that I had grown up around. But, you know, what a lot of African philosophers say is that it can be almost impossible to translate this idea of Ubuntu into a language like English, because they sometimes aren't even the words to describe it, because the English language itself is based on Western philosophical ideas. And so it can be hard to kind of give people a sense of it. And so what I like to do is think a lot more about the kinds of examples of what Ubuntu can look like. And, you know, in the book, I talk about this idea of nimbes, which is these collective agricultural practices that folks use in Zimbabwe to reap a harvest. They will throw a party where villagers will come together and help one family and their harvest to kind of get done for the season, and they'll drink and they'll tell stories, and there'll be an oral storytelling tradition going on in the background. So there's this cultural work happening at the same time as everyone is reinforcing these bonds, and we're helping this person with the thing that they need, and no money is exchanging hands in the process. To me, that's powerful.
Yeah, we decided to experiment here at the theater with a show that's at our Second City ETC stage that my wife Anne is directing, called Improv Supernova. Mm. And it's a completely improvised show. And normally we use improv to write our sketch reviews. And this is an experiment in part because of the times we're living in, to see if, you know, we can take the temperature every night of the audience, speak directly to that audience and what they're thinking and feeling, and give them a show in response to that. So the show literally opens with the cast, many of the cast members, going to the audience and having extended conversations. So it's like the lights aren't, you know, sort of, they're still kind of on, and we're feeling out people. And then we come up on stage and we start relating what these conversations are, and then we move in into the improv. And one of the things, I've only seen this a couple times, and I've been watching tapes of the show, but one of the things that's really beautiful is it just immediately opens up the space where everyone sort of, we're collectively telling our stories. It's not just the actors who are up on a stage, right? And the audience is playing a much more sort of prominent role, and it's kinetic and it's fun. And sometimes it's a little scary because someone says something in the audience that maybe the rest of the audience is like, I don't know about that, what you just said. But because the feeling is so warm, we're like, okay, let's just try to all be on the same team here. Let's see, we're going to get through this evening together. We're going to laugh. And it is deeply pro-social. Mm-hmm. And it gets at the sort of heart of our field, because in improvisation, at Second City in particular, you know, the art form demands that you take care of each other. And we produce tons of stars. All those stars are grounded in work that demands that they took care of the other. And I think it would be almost impossible to not take that with you into other realms of your life, because you're just like, this is your training. And my best experiences in the medical field are when I feel like that, when I feel like someone is truly listening to me, seeing me, understanding when I'm scared. And then also they need to see it back. That's the other thing.
I think that's very powerful. And I wanted to share that I have encountered yes and before in my medical training. Mm-hmm. It was something that was taught to us by an incredible mentor of mine who is this expert in like patient-doctor communication. And her name is Amy Shipp, and she was my program director at the Brigham. And she taught us about yes and taught us how to take yes and into our patient encounters. And it totally changes the whole experience of being with someone and sitting with them. It transforms the very kind of hierarchical relationship between patient and doctor to just come down to the same level and say, I'm here for you. Tell me more, yes, and to whatever it is that they are bringing to you that day. And I find it a very powerful framing.
I love that. So this book, and I love when books do this. It's so much more powerful when you're weaving your own story throughout to explain the impact. You say in chapter one, quote, I have been shaped by my mother's experience with mental distress. So talk to us a bit about how you grew up, what that was like, and how that put you, how that led to us having even this conversation today.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up and my mom was mentally unwell when I was a child. And that was something that we had to contend with often in our home. And I think that, you know, at the time, the way that we saw things shifted. At first, you know, she was seeing our primary care doctor, and she was being prescribed antidepressants and a low-grade antipsychotic, and those things were helping her. And the idea that she, you know, she was suffering from depression or some other kind of mental illness was very helpful for her. It was a sort of a liberating thing to be diagnosed with a mental illness, in part because those ideas of like Western scientific namings were valuable to her, especially growing up in a country that was post-colonial, where, you know, we had been taught that the way white people and the way they perceive the world, the way white people perceive the world is really the most important way of doing things. And with that comes science, and with that comes medicine. And my mom was a science teacher herself. And so to be given these diagnoses were extremely helpful for her to manage her own distress, to have some understanding of where it came from. But over time, it became obvious to me that her mental distress was also tied to her bank balance. When my family had a windfall and things were going our way, she did better. And when we were in debt and when things were hard and when we went through hyperinflation in Zimbabwe, this was a moment in the 2000s. So at the one point in, say, 2008, you could go to a coffee shop in Zimbabwe and order a cappuccino and it would be $2 million. And if you had another cappuccino 30 minutes later or an hour later, it could be $4 million. And if you had another one an hour after that, it could be $8 million. People were putting up their prices like that at a rate that was totally unfathomable. The inflation rate was 6.78 sextillion percent, I believe. And that's more zeros than really I know how to write out. Mm-hmm. And it was extremely unmooring for her. I watched her come apart at the seams. And she had what she called these nervous breakdowns, which were these periods of paralytic mental distress where she couldn't get out of bed, where she couldn't do what she wanted to be able to do in society. And that was hard for her. That was hard for us. But those experiences I took with me to college and I took with me to graduate school in anthropology and in medicine, because I was looking for some answers, and psychiatry was the answer that I thought I was looking for until I learned about the conditions that my patients themselves were living in. And I think it was encountering patients in my research as an anthropologist and in the clinic as a physician much, much later in life where I was able to piece all of these things together and sort of figure out what was going on. I had a patient in clinic during residency called Alice who came to me with these fainting spells. She was having these sudden fainting spells in church, on the street, in her kitchen. I even saw her collapse in the office once in front of me. And I sent her for every, you know, test in the books. I thought she might be having a cardiac condition because people with arrhythmias can suddenly black out. So I sent her for an echocardiogram and Holter monitoring and stress tests. You might be familiar with some of those, given your upcoming surgery. And there was nothing. And I sent her to a neurologist and for a brain MRI and for, EEG monitoring to see if she had a seizure. Nothing. The neurologist said to me, I think she has functional illness, which is doctor speak for, I think it's in her head. But I could tell that what was going on was real. She was covered in cuts and bruises. It was affecting her life. And I was worried one day she was going to fall, hit her head and die. And so, you know, her safety was really, really important to me. And what my preceptor at the time, Amy Shipp, decided was we should be bringing her back more often. And we brought her back as often as I could see her in primary care. I brought her back on a weekly when I could and bi-weekly basis. And I just did the things that primary care doctors do for patients. So I listened to her heart and lungs. Mm-hmm. I spoke to her about what was going on at home. I did her pap smears. And over time, I got to know a little bit more about what was going on with Alice. She was living on the edges of poverty. She had an extremely large caregiving burden taking care of her mother. And she was extremely, extremely lonely. She was housing insecure and couldn't find a good place to live. And over time, we sort of spoke about some of those problems. I was able to offer her some therapy around them, some kind of psychosocial support. I was able to prescribe her the antidepressants that she needed in order to also stay afloat. I was able to connect her with housing through filling out forms that showed that she had a mental illness and that she could be eligible for subsidized housing. This is a process called social prescribing, where physicians actually really can make a difference in people's lives by writing sometimes literal prescriptions for food, housing, and other types of care that go beyond the clinic. And we did this, you know, dance for 1-2 years. And eventually she walked into the office and said, "Doc, I've stopped fainting." And she had this huge smile on her face. And she was implying that I was the one who helped her to stop fainting. And I can't point to what I did or how I did it or anything, any one particular thing. But what I could tell was that these social conditions really had a bearing on her life and her illness and shaped it in ways that made me really rethink the way I was approaching the problem.
So this is the very unique thing that I got out of reading this book, which is, of course, it's systemic. You have got colonialism, capitalism, oppression, you know, racism, misogyny. These things are real. Mm-hmm. It's individualistic in that you need individuals to step up at some point and do kind of what you did. But you had to also operate in that system. And then a layer I didn't expect you to lay on was this kind of generosity to everyone, because you talk about how violence isn't just bad for the people who experience the violence, but it's bad for the people who are committing the violence and the generations after them. And that, I think that's a hard thing for a lot of people to, you know, show grace for. But it felt to me like it made great sense, and it allows, it's kind of a place where you just allow everyone to hit a reset button if they just would, and say, like, we can attack this differently. We can do better.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that is what I'm asking for. You know, I'm calling for us to imagine things differently. And what I really hope is that, you know, I used to think about mental health in a very specific way. As these events happened to me in my life and as I gained these experiences, the way that I thought about it changed. As I wrote this book and derived meaning out of those events to figure out like what they meant to me, my understanding of mental health changed. And this book is a snapshot in time of kind of my imagination and where things are. I hope it's not where we stop thinking about these things. Right. I think that, you know, this is a provocation to figure out what it is within your own life that you could be doing within the, you know, confines of the farm that you want to, you know, the metaphor that you want, the seeds that you want to sow and the farm that you want to reap. And I think that if anything, that's kind of what I'm trying to do here is provoke.
When I was in college, there's a bookstore in Evanston right near Northwestern, called Bookman's Alley. And it was, you know, down this sort of like cobblestone alley, and it had room upon room upon room of used books. And Roger Carlson, who ran it, was this, he always had coffee going, and I just get lost in there for hours and hours and hours. And I would leave with unexpected books. That's what I loved about it. It wasn't like I just went to like my one section. And there's a book I remember leaving with by Thomas Szasz called The Myth of Mental Illness. Mm-hmm. And there is nothing in my past that would have said why I would have picked up this book. There's not like a history of mental illness in my family that I'm aware of. But it had a very, very profound effect on me. And I feel, if I'm remembering it correctly, very similar to your thesis in terms of you're not anti, you know, therapy and psychiatry and all these things. But however, our framing maybe ain't great. Let's put it that way.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, The Myth of Mental Illness, interesting book. It has been picked up by the Scientologists as their sort of
go-to
explanation for the way that they see psychiatry. And it is part of a movement called anti-psychiatry. And so, you know, the folks in this movement are doing some important work in helping us think through things. My argument, though, is a yes and argument. My argument with psychiatry is a yes. And also, there's so much more out there. There's so many other ways that we can be thinking about mental distress. And, you know, from different cultures, from different disciplines, there are so many different approaches around the world. What I want to do is destabilize the dominance of this very one way of thinking about things, so that folks can realize that, you know, there are more humane ways of approaching things. There's this psychiatrist, Tom Insel, who used to be the director of the NIMH, and he writes that 90% of our mental health comes from our zip code, from our race, from our gender, and from, you know, those kinds of social conditions, and only about 10% comes from mental health care, in other words, psychiatry. And my problem at the moment with that is that the balance of the way that we treat these conditions is only focused on that 10%. And we need to be thinking about that other 90% really, really seriously, because that's the majority of where our mental health is coming from in the first place. And so, you know, I think that the myth of mental illness and how it fits into all of these things is definitely okay, yes, and this is not nearly enough to get us to move the needle on all of the other things that determine whether people are mentally well or not.
So then one of the huge problems is the sort of financial incentives of big pharma, mm-hmm. Right? I mean, it's so we mentioned this before we jumped on the podcast, how odd it is, the cascade of these conversations, because one of the last podcast I taped was with a guy named Jake Braun, mm-hmm. who is in the Biden administration and the Obama administration fighting the war on fentanyl. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's funny because he even started the conversation going, I couldn't even spell fentanyl. You know, and it was like, but then he tells the history of it and with the cartels and all those other things. And it's just fascinating. Right. And when my daughter was sick and she was on Oxy, right. And I every time I saw that bottle, I had this sort of reaction and, you know, is it helping to save her and decrease pain? And is there's a, mm-hmm. it's so complicated. And when you talk about the history of psychology, you talk about the shift from biological to psychoanalytical and then back again.
Mm-hmm. In other words, psychiatry has already had a reckoning with itself.
Yeah.
And this is something that people don't realize, is the reckoning that we're having right now historically has already happened. And so there's precedent for rethinking the way that we do things in psychiatry. And, you know, what I'm calling for here is yet another shift in the way that we think about psychiatry and mental health problems towards something that is more collective and structural, and involves, you know, not just what we're doing in the hospital, in the clinic, but care outside of medical institutions that is also social and political. There are so many other ways of engaging with mental health that have nothing to do with medical care itself. And I think, like, ultimately, you know, mental health is spiritual and psychological and biological, but it's also social and political. What I would like is for the social and the political to be the more dominant narrative. And the reason that I think that that's important is because, you know, in the biological narrative, mental illness is a little bit, there's like not much you can do, because if mental illness comes from your genes, from your genetics, well, what do we do with that, Kelly? The answer is nothing, because in 30 years of, you know, mental health research that's been focused on genetics, we haven't changed the way that we treat mental illnesses. We still treat them very much the same way that psychiatry has been treating them for a long time, with these medications that help people relieve their symptoms, but have nothing to do with the, you know, genetic basis of our mental health problems. And that's because we can't change our genes. Our genes are our genes. They're what we've been given. But you know what we can change, Kelly, is our social conditions. And so if we can get the medical establishment on board with kind of framing mental health problems this way, their dominant hold, you know, the medical establishment has such a dominant hold on how we decide to express our mental health problems, because it's in the ether, it's in the public health messaging, it's in, you know, it's all over the place that, you know, if you have a mental health problem, then you need to go and seek help. These are the symptoms. This is what it looks like. We don't want to miss that. But, you know, as good as that mental health awareness kind of campaign might be, with it comes with this dominant hold on the way we tell stories about ourselves and about other people. And I want us to be telling a story about mental health that is far more expansive, far more capacious than the one that we're currently doing.
Yeah, because people should have food. There's enough food in this country to feed people.
Exactly. People should,
there are, you know, empty rooms all over the city that I live in, and we can't figure out a way to put the so I drive down Lakeshore Drive mostly. Mm-hmm. So the north side of Chicago, and I come to Old Town here at Second City. And when I first started coming to Second City, like in the 80s and 90s, there weren't tents all along Lakeshore Drive in the park where people are living in January and February in Chicago, when it's like no one should be out in those conditions.
In the richest country in the world.
In the richest country in the world. It's insane. And one of the most provocative chapters in this book was when you talk about hoarding. Because I think when we think about it, of course, we go to Hoarders. We go to the TV series and we go to the stories. And you even have one of someone you were treating where, you know, you're going into that room and it's, how are they not falling? And we know falling is a terrible thing. Mm-hmm. But so I want you to talk a little bit about that, but then also about the other people who hoard in this mm-hmm. country.
Yeah. You know, I a lot crystallized for me in that moment in medical school when I was on this amazing program called the Visiting Doctors Program at Mount Sinai, where we see patients in their homes, which is how doctors used to see patients until, you know, actually fairly recently. The idea of the clinic and the hospital are a fairly new invention, and the clinic and the hospital as the site of care, actually help corporatized healthcare systems to see patients more quickly. And seeing patients in their conditions that they fall in helps us to give them better treatment, because we get a better sense of where their conditions are coming from. And my precept and I are moving through this apartment of this patient, Daniel, and I had never really quite been in an apartment like this before. It was full of People magazines piled high and full of cans and, you know, grocery bags full of stuff, and you could barely move. And I fell over in this patient's apartment. And the reason we were seeing him was because he himself had been falling. But it was really when I like went home that evening as a medical student, I was sort of reading my textbooks to think about hoarding disorder, which is a diagnosis that is in the DSM. Mm-hmm. And it is, you know, a disorder that can be treated with SSRIs. And, you know, what really defines both hoarding disorder and any psychiatric illness, what makes any emotional distress a psychiatric problem, is if that issue is causing harm to yourself or to other people around you. That's when things become a problem. And so, you know, we felt like maybe he had hoarding disorder because he was a harm to himself, because he was falling all over these things in his apartment. But then I started to think about some of the richest people in the world, you know, the folks on the Forbes rich list, Jeff Bezos, you know, people who are hoarding wealth mm-hmm. away from the rest of the world at a moment when the world is in great, great need, in a way that is harmful to the rest of the world. Yet they are lauded and congratulated for their hoarding. And what that made me realize is that a lot of the framing around psychiatric illnesses are double standards. We apply them to some people and not others. Poor people living under scarce conditions who hoard stuff because they feel like they need it in order to survive, are considered diseased and pathological. But Jeff Bezos, you know, who's the working conditions of his workshop, of his Amazon warehouses are just horrendous, and who's hoarding away wealth from so many people, is given awards for what he's doing and not considered ill at all, makes you realize that so many of these things are about who gets to decide what is going on with you, rather than you getting to decide that for yourself. And, you know, there are so many examples of psychiatry and medicine doing this. Borderline personality disorder is a, you know, an illness that is given very often to women who are disagreeable and emotionally volatile, or, you know, in some ways difficult for the people around them. And it's an incredibly stigmatizing diagnosis that psychiatry says we can do nothing about, really. And that's a problem. But schizophrenia is another example of a diagnosis that you would think would be applied evenly, because there's no biological reason for schizophrenia to appear in one group more than another. But Black people, especially Black men, are diagnosed with rates of schizophrenia far greater than white people and white men. And that ends up sending them down a pathway that may not be the right pathway for them. And, you know, these types of biases are inherent to medicine and inherent to psychiatry. And so while I can see how sometimes these diagnoses can be helpful, I really want us to be rethinking whether or not we should be using them at all.
Or using them more fairly across.
Yeah.
Because the scarcity idea in behavioral science applies to all of us in some regard. And this is another area where I think you're really generous, because you write in the book, quote, "History keeps repeating itself because people in the dominant caste truly feel unsafe. They are genuinely terrified. They want safe spaces, but they cannot see that they are the safest people in the world," end quote. Wow, that to me explains a lot of what's going on today.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, this is a part of this idea comes from some social epidemiologists called Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett, who have this wonderful book called The Spirit Level that shows how inequality causes poor health outcomes. And they have a follow-up book called The Inner Level, which shows how inequality causes mental health problems. And what they really show is that in extremely hierarchical societies, where the difference between the people at the top and the people at the bottom is very steep, there is worse mental health for everyone, including the people at the top. In other words, you know, in a place like America, with such massive inequality, that inequality has a bearing not just for poor people, but for you and I, Kelly, people who, you know, as you started this conversation, you know, with your admission of privilege, it doesn't mean that, like, we are not affected by these conditions that force us to see the world and to see our social lives in this very hierarchical way. Breaking down that hierarchy, the pro-sociality that we've been talking about, is the goal here.
Yeah. And in a moment, I'm going to ask you for a yes and story, even though you've given us two, so I feel bad about that. But before I have one more question before we get to that, which is, seems to me something I've heard from every medical professional I've ever encountered is the importance of sleep, right? Sleep is really important for our bodies. I was in the hospital a couple weeks ago and they didn't let me sleep.
It's so the worst.
Yeah, what's going on there?
So bad at that. So there's so much going on here. You know, I think, and I, you know, I will, my kind of like, my caveat is that I'm not a sleep medicine doctor, and I, you know, I'm not a sleep researcher either. I think sleep is super, super important. And I do think that when folks are in the hospital, the attitude to sleep is one of complete indifference. And it, you know, we have our patients lying in bed and they're these bleeping monitors. We come in and take their blood pressure every 8 hours, sometimes every 4 or every 2 hours. We poke them. We, you know, check morning labs and evening labs. And I think that a lot of, you know, I can speak to the hospital sleep environment better than I can speak to kind of outpatient sleep ideas, but that hospital sleep environment comes from this very kind of Western scientific, idea that more data is better. And so, you know, constant surveillance is how we're going to actually help our patients. If we have more labs, more numbers, more scans, more blood pressure readings, more eyes on the patients, eventually something will come to us and we'll figure out what's going on and we'll fix them. So, you know, I had a patient, I had a preceptor when I was in residency who, whenever patients complained about their lack of sleep overnight, would say, "Honey, this is a hospital, not a hotel." And I remember just like, as a resident, just being like, wow, that's so mean. Because, you know, I'm someone who, without sleep, I am a nightmare to be around. And I really, you know, understood where my patients were coming from. And I still, like, try to make sure that they get as much sleep as possible. I'm a nocturnist. So I'm a doctor who works exclusively at nighttime. And so I'm constantly dealing with patients who are awake at night. And whenever I have the opportunity, I put in their charts orders for no vitals overnight. And what that means is like no one should be disturbing their sleep. I think sleep is really important. But how to kind of change the system to make sure that things don't happen that way means that medicine has to have a real reckoning with all of this unnecessary data collection that we do. And we have to be rethinking why we do these things for really most of the time for no reason.
Great. I appreciate all that. We always end with a yes and story. You've given us a couple, as I said. If you wanted to elaborate even more on those, that's fine. I don't know if you have another one, but that's how we're going to end the pod.
I mean, I have a yes and story about a friend of mine, Tanaka, who is a queer person living in Zimbabwe. And, you know, Zimbabwe is an extremely oppressive place for queer people. The laws are essentially that homosexuality is illegal. And then the social and cultural environment is extremely, extremely violent and oppressive towards queer people. And Tanaka had been struggling for a while with their mental health and was seeing a therapist, but came to me because they wanted me to accompany them to see a traditional healer. Now, in Zimbabwe, as a mental health researcher, I knew quite a lot about traditional healers because they work in a parallel healthcare system to mental health care providers, along with witch doctors, sangomas, herbalists, spirit mediums. You know, it's a whole group of kind of folks that people often go to as the first port of call for their mental health problems. And so I was interested and I agreed to go, but I had always been trained to think about traditional healers as almost a barrier to mental health care, as in we got to get these folks on board so they can send us the real cases of mental illness to us doctors. And so we can take care of the, you know, patients that really need help. And I went with Tanaka out into a rural part of Zimbabwe and we went into the home of this traditional healer. Her name was Ambuya Patricia, which means grandmother Patricia. And her healing room was full of these little trinkets, sticks and powders and potions. And she had some swords and like amulets and animal skins around us. It was an environment that I, you know, was so not used to being in, but was so fascinated by. And we sat down and she asked us to blow some tobacco in the air while she took a swig of what I can only imagine was very strong alcohol. And she went into this trance-like state and spoke with the elders and spoke in a completely different voice to the one that we had started off speaking with her in, and basically told Tanaka that they needed to repair some of the bonds in their family, that the fights that they were having with their aunt, their uncle, and their mother were causing a lot of discord. And they needed to go back and repair those things. She gave them 2 months to do this. And it was in that moment that I realized that what she was doing for Tanaka right there was no different to cognitive behavioral therapy. You know, what she was doing was a type of mental health care. Mm-hmm. And it was a transformational moment for me, because what I realized was that, yes, psychiatrists are mental health providers and psychologists are mental health care providers, but Indigenous healers are mental health care providers too. And so are we all. We are all mental health care providers, because we all have a stake in our shared well-being. And it behooves us to participate in that shared well-being, because what we are doing here on this phone call, Kelly, is also a form of mental health care, showing up for each other, listening to each other, and really kind of holding space for the ideas that we have and the stories that we're bringing to the table. That is mental health care. And I want everyone to go home and remember that we have a stake in our shared collective lives, and that we are all mental health care providers.
You're making me remember something. So early in my career at Second City, the woman who was the producer before me was a woman named Joyce Sloan, who was like the Jewish mother of Second City, right? And mm-hmm. a legend in Chicago, and was always sticking her nose in your business. And she knew my family pretty well, because she knew my dad, who had been a theater critic here in town. And I was at odds with one of my brothers and his wife at the time. And I actually hadn't seen him like in a year. And she would ask about it every once in a while. And one time she came in my office, she's like, "You got to fix this." And I'm like, "What?" And she gave it to me. And she's like, "I'm telling you right now, you were going to regret this if you let this last on any longer." And I actually made the phone call that night and got things back on track and everything's fine. But I just, it's this intervention that only she could have done. Is, you know, I grew up Catholic, but this was my Jewish grandmother coming in telling me get my crap together. And occasionally we just all have to do that for each other. And
self-responsible, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, made you realize that you needed to be responsible too. And I think that, you know, we've become so atomized and individualized in this culture that, that responsibility to each other is what I feel like we're lacking.
Same. The book is called Empire of Madness, A Physician's Case for Reimagining Global Mental Health. Kamir Kidia, thank you so much for coming on the pod.
Pleasure was all mine, Kelly.
Getting DS And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Iridian Fierro from WGN. We get support at the Second City from Emma Smith and Colleen Fahey. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.